You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 159, for the 13th of March, 2019. I'm your host, Stephen Wagner. Chris Webster couldn't join us today. On today's show, we're talking with Lewis Bork about his article, Constructing the Future History, and how it applies to CRM Archaeology. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Bill in Maryland.
Hey there.
West Coast Bill. Not in Maryland.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm not in Maryland. Maryland's nice, though.
Well, it's kind of gray this morning, but yeah.
And Sonia in Utah.
Hello.
Like I mentioned, our special guest today is Lewis Bork. Lewis, hi.
Hello.
Why don't you introduce yourself for the audience so they know who we're talking to?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I'm a researcher and assistant professor at the University of Leiden in the Faculty of Archaeology. I'm basically a visiting assistant professor here. But I've spent the last 15 years working in the U.S. in the American Southwest primarily. And prior to going to grad school, I worked for the federal government as an archaeologist. And then during grad school, I worked as a contract archaeologist before starting to work at a research and outreach nonprofit called Archaeology Southwest while I was working on my degree. And after getting my degree, then I've been over here in the Netherlands.
And the reason we asked you on to this show is because you had recently published an article entitled Constructing the Future History, Prefiguration as Historical Epistemology and the Chronopolitics of Archaeology. I really like the word chronopolitics, so we had to get you on.
Yeah.
Could you outline briefly what this article is about?
Yeah, I can. And I mean, the title obviously is, I don't want to say it's jargony, but it's definitely technical words for people in very specific sectors, I guess. But it's trying to pull together historical theory from radically different areas and tie them together through archaeology. So I'm looking at the chronopolitics ideas is coming from researchers in historical geographies, and prefiguration is coming out of activist praxis in like the last 20 years, but really kind of laid out about 100 years or so ago. And that's kind of this competing idea about how you can actually institute change in social systems, and whether you can, whether the ends justify the means versus whether the means create the ends. It's kind of this coupling or decoupling of results from your actions. And the whole thing is actually just kind of curious about, I was curious about what types of histories we're going to have to draw on when we start to think about potentials for organizing social governments or social institutions outside of the contemporary neoliberal or capitalist states. Obviously, a huge chunk of that archive is going to be coming from the archaeological record and the historical record. And as archaeologists, most of what we're preserving is through a lot of these preservation management decisions. And so having sat and given public talks and just kind of had general conversations with people about sites that they found important in the American Southwest, which is where my primary focus is, became more and more apparent that a lot of the areas people are highly interested in are ones that are more traditionally organized in a more vertical fashion, similar to contemporary states, or more hierarchical fashion. So Chaco Canyon's obviously a really good example of that. Mesa Verde during the 1200s and 1300s. The Hohokam period from about 1200 to 1450. All of these periods end up with a lot of researchers working on them because they have, I and other people have argued, because they just look a lot more similar to our current form of governance, I guess. And so
sure.
If the idea was kind of that if we're sort of highlighting what we already are practicing, we're going to start running out of alternative ideas if we think of the archaeological record as a kind of radical archive or an archive of alternative governance practices. And so I was coming at this from a more critical perspective, using a lot of theory from anarchist practice, I guess, and methodology and indigenous critiques of colonial archaeologists. And so the idea here, especially with the anarchist stuff, is anarchist theories, it's really, I mean, it has a very vibrant community. A lot of it's actually called post-anarchism now, because they don't always use the term anymore, because everyone's so afraid of the term, because it has connotations of negative connotations, where people think you're just talking about chaos if they don't understand it, or they think you're going to blow up a government building as well. So there's negatives on that side. But the longstanding idea behind it is how people can organize, and specifically organize a just society without any formal rulers. So if you look at the kind of traditional anarchist symbol, like the A crossing over the O, that's actually from the 1700s. And it was done so that people would stop thinking of, a rulerless society as unordered and chaotic. So that O actually stands for order. And then the A obviously is anarchy or without rulers. So really that symbol is standing in for order without rulers. Okay, so that's the broad focus. That's where I started from, kind of trying to look at this more critical perspective on UNESCO heritage management decisions, at least. And I knew it would be problematic in terms of, you know, us having us as archaeologists and heritage management professionals having a focus more on these sort of state-like institutions. And I just didn't realize quite how bad it would be until I kind of tallied all the UNESCO cultural heritage sites up. And I think in total for North America, Canada, U.S., Mexico, and then I combined all the Caribbean countries as well that have UNESCO sites. I think in total, 90% are hierarchically organized, so vertically organized, and 10% of those are more horizontally or organized more flatly, which is really kind of the inverse of what our political organization has looked like in history of the Americas. It's more 10% of the time has been vertically organized versus horizontally organized. So the concern was that we're erasing these potential non-state, more just organizational practices through our heritage management decisions.
I kind of want to do a counterpoint that part of the reason we're really interested in those later, more complex societies, and I'm more familiar from the, you know, like the Midwest with the Mississippian stuff, it is, you know, part of that is because it's like the material density of these sites is, you know, way larger than what you're dealing with before that. And so I don't know that it's so much as like, yes, they're hierarchical and so are we, and we're going to do it, so much as like, look at all this stuff. And look at this art and the complexity of, like, you know, like the variety of ceramics and all of this. There's a lot more material culture to kind of key in on. And then also to get to the earlier non-hierarchical stuff, you're going to have to plow through it. So, you know, and who wants to do that, right? Like, you know, like, don't necessarily want to dig through existing, you know, components to get to earlier ones. So, you know, I wonder if it's not actually, you know, the nature of the material culture rather than the social hierarchy of the groups who are studying.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I can respond to that, that's...
Oh, yeah.
I think, that's sort of the kind of implicit ideas that I've been trying to push back against, because I think that's kind of how people have just assumed that we've been moving forward with this. Oh, these hierarchical societies often build these really large scale structures. And so they're just more visibly prominent. So that's why we end up looking at those. The reality is, though, we have just as often ignored these large scale structures from non-hierarchical societies as well. Or what we end up doing is interpreting them automatically as hierarchical societies. And that's the story that we end up telling to visitors when they come to these sites. So Poverty Point, of course, being a really good example of that until fairly recently. But, and then the density thing becomes, it certainly is an issue in terms of you end up with higher levels of population density sometimes in hierarchically organized sites. And part of this has to do with state formation processes and simplification of organizational practices that go along with population densities. And so you have all this with Jim Scott and Norm Yaffe have called legibility, where you end up, as you're getting these massive levels of people coming together, you have all of these practices that funnel organization into fewer and fewer people because it's easier to manage large-scale groups that way. So in some ways, we have to decouple this idea of easiness from betterness, I guess, justness. That's a different story or a different topic. But in terms of density, like, you know, when we look at archaeology in the American Southwest, and we're looking at density of archaeological sites that have primarily more hierarchical organizational practices, like Chaco and Chacoan-related sites, versus ones that are more horizontally organized. We actually have a higher level, higher density of these horizontally organized sites than we do with Chacoan sites or sites up in the Mesa Verde region. So I work in the Guayana region, which is, if you think of Chaco Canyon and Santa Fe, the Rio Grande, and Mesa Verde as three points on a triangle. And, the area I work at is basically right in the middle there. And we've got something around 2,500 structural sites in this area. And it's not a particularly huge area, but it's just kind of been erased in the archaeological research record because it isn't that they're not building massive structures. They're certainly not building Pueblo Bonitos out there, but they're definitely building things dramatically larger in terms of pit structures and with a lot more effort put into them than you see in the Mesa Verde region, where you have far more researchers working on it. So there is, of course, some sort of bias in terms of preservation that's happening because of visibility. But then also you get down to like the Hohokam area where, you know, a lot of these massive, and Bill knows this quite well too, a lot of these massive public works projects that are happening down there, excluding these large-scale platform mounds that they get, which come up during a much more hierarchical period, are actually built in during periods that are kind of decoupled from hierarchy. A lot more horizontal decision-making is happening. And so they have these huge irrigation canals put together alongside a lot of ball courts that are dug. So there are these, you guys, I mean, those are completely valid concerns, and there is some sort of reality to that. But the other side of this is even if it is just simply that these things are easier to see, that doesn't really negate the concern that alternative organizational practices are getting not preserved as effectively.
Okay. Bill typed up, since he's having trouble communicating with you, that the U.S. is not part of the UNESCO Heritage Convention, and that but these are like state groups that are doing the recommendations of these sites to the heritage list. So I don't know if you have a response.
Yeah, I mean, when I started this, it was before we'd pulled out of UNESCO. Obviously, the peer review practice doesn't move as quickly as politics. And so that's the primary response to that. I mean, the reality is this is just a test study to see if there are problematic issues with how we're actually making heritage management decisions, whether we're taking into account the full scope of organizational practices like this. And what I argue in the article is that UNESCO is, you know, probably a poor case study because it is incredibly top down already.
So we're going to take a break. When you come back, Bill is going to ask Lewis a question about Australia, and we will tie it all into current CRM practice. See you after the break.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.archpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.archpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
Welcome back. We were having some technical issues in that first segment, and hopefully we've got them all worked out. We're going to start up with West Coast Bill. I had a question for Lewis.
Yeah, Lewis, in the article, using the UNESCO thing, as you mentioned, is probably not going to show indigenous participation because it is such a top-down thing with the states parties kind of controlling the whole nomination process and everything. But I do know that, you know, it's a system that's fraught with problems. However, I've known of some successes, at least limited successes, specifically with indigenous individuals in Australia in their campaign to change the way that the tourism of Uluru or Ayers Rock influences their heritage properties. So I guess is the next step to try and find some kind of way to capture indigenous participation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so one of the things that I was interested in looking at was how a lot of these concerns that are brought up by indigenous groups about, you know, what sites those the political practices that might correspond to those sites might be captured through other non-cultural heritage management protection processes, like the natural sites through UNESCO. Like, what sort of sites were captured during those? And because the Grand Canyon's one of these big ones, right? That has a ton of archaeological sites collected within it or captured within this UNESCO registration. The concern that I had for that, and this is a concern that is shared by a lot of Native colleagues of mine, is that the very process of incorporating these things into these natural landscapes instead of cultural landscapes sort of delegitimizes a lot of the extremely powerful effort towards more equitable and non-hierarchical political practices that are embedded within those time periods. So that's a long a way of saying, yeah, that should be the next step. Part of what I want to do with some of the fieldwork I'm doing is to start a broader conversation about what that might look like. And I think in the U.S., though, it's already happening in terms of all the mobilizations that have occurred, you know, not just with No DAPL, but in the Southwest, more particularly around Bears Ears, there's been a huge amount of local and indigenous participation in formulating and defining boundaries and, you know, what types of sites are important to maintain. And so that sort of landscape-based scale is coupled with a focus on cultural landscapes instead of just accidentally capturing these things in natural landscapes, you know, quote unquote natural landscapes, is really, I think, a powerful way that we can move forward with this.
So to try to pivot this a little to sort of using sort of these ideas and the interpretation of sites and maybe eventually to the how it fits in within the world of CRM. I'm going to use mostly a historical example because that's sort of my wheelhouse on things. But I was thinking in terms of the idea of like horizontal groupings within vertical societies. Specifically, a lot of what I deal with here is in the East Coast of the United States, and I spent a lot of time looking at enslaved communities within sort of antebellum periods in the United States. So the enslaved community itself could be seen as a horizontal society since there are no hierarchies within that. But they're operating within a vertical society. So how do you identify and work through that? That's something that's sort of been going on for the last 20, 30 years of sort of how do you see the horizontal within a vertical society? So it's not even just a broader society that's spread out overall as a horizontal, but how do you look at it when it's embedded within an existing hierarchical vertical society? And I've also known some of the work done by Michael Roller from University of Maryland, looking at miners up in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and sort of looking at like these embedded horizontal communities and possibly forced to be horizontal because of the pressures of the vertical society. And how do you find them? That's because that's been a very hot topic in the world of CRM in the past 10 years, maybe 20 years, of identifying sort of these more marginalized communities more than we had initially in the past. No longer are, you know, tours and discussions of plantations just about look at the big house and look at this founding father who did all these great things. We are now finally using our lens to focus on the enslaved who build and worked and so forth. So thinking how the ideas of chronotype and other things can sort of work while and to help interpret sites.
I mean, anyone else can jump in here to answer that as well, because I certainly don't have even remotely have all the answers. This is more a small case study to say, you know, hey, we need to be more aware of a lot of these decisions we're making because there's all these kind of implicit biases that are built or that are kind of drilled into us as we grow up in a state and in a capitalist society. But I think, the concerns you have are definitely shared in non-historical contexts as well. I mean, that's really kind of just replicating this idea of, you know, let's preserve Pueblo Bonito, and we'll give all the visitors a huge talk based on, you know, the people who lived here, and we'll just ignore all the small sites within Chaco Canyon where people, you know, have food deficiencies and we're clearly at, you know, decoupled from the centers of power that you're seeing on the north side of the canyon. So it's not happening in that particular UNESCO environment, but it I think is starting to happen in the Mesa Verde area more generally. But it's a complicated balance, I think.
I mean, it is something, you know, trying to see these other people within there, especially in communities. I mean, to sort of move it into the world of CRM, you have sort of the predominant national government and state governments with their sort of their hierarchies, and trying to look for others, whether they're the indigenous or others in there, is a struggle at times. And I think it's something we deal with on a regular basis. But one other thing I noticed reading over your paper was the idea and the reminder of archaeology itself being a political act, being an act of creating history rather than sort of rediscovery. Like we uncover the things of the past to tell a story to the present to create what the future understands as the past. So I like that a lot, and I don't know if you want to maybe explain a little more about that idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's other people on here as well that I think are just as able to answer this. So, you know, please do jump in. But it's for me, it's always been a big concern. A few of the places that I've worked at, and you know, having worked in the land management sector for a while as well, there's clearly a decoupling from what we're actually doing as we're preserving these sites or as we're practicing archaeology from how that may affect the contemporary world. You know, it seems like there's some sort of ahistory that's involved with archaeology. I actually got chastised on a Southwestern archaeology listserv when I was in grad school because I congratulated skateboards for entering the archaeological record as a joke about the 50-year rule. And I had a whole bunch of Southwestern archaeologists jump down my throat for derailing the listserv away from Southwestern archaeology. And so it goes to show how decoupled a lot of archaeologists can be from this sort of idea that, you know, what we're really doing is studying the material world, and our interactions with that material world are completely political. And then how we use that material world to write these histories is completely political. So the idea of this paper is to just get people aware of their political orientation or what the political ramifications are, I think, for the decisions they're making. I mean, one of the concerns I had that I haven't gotten to, and this might go back to a question Bill was asking earlier, is you know, how do we actually go about trying to implement this? And I don't, you know, I have no answers for that in a federal or state or context, especially ones where, you know, you've got a right of way for the I-10 corridor or something like that. There's not a whole lot of decisions that you can make in terms of where you're working at or what you're working on. You know, having worked in the, you know, the quote unquote preservation or conservation nonprofit sector for quite a while, I did see a really concerning pattern where people were just making conservation or preservation decisions about archaeological sites simply based on the presence or the availability or the ability to actually purchase that site or put it into a conservation easement. And so one of the things I think that needs to happen is for a lot of these nonprofits to take a broader perspective and to look at like what this kind of body of archaeology of the archaeological record that they've preserved or constructed, you know, what it's actually preserving, and start to look at whether they're skewing in one direction or another. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a political organization of these groups. It could be anything from, oh, we've got too many ancestral autumn sites. We should, you know, focus on getting some Apache sites preserved.
Yeah, I think that one of the big things that I've seen that can kind of get around this is not really a metrics of sorts, but a kind of willingness among certain communities to just go ahead and take control of their own historic preservation, whether that's using the National Historic Preservation Act or using UNESCO or whatever, and then managing it in their own way. And the example that I think of closely is the stuff that I've seen going on in St. Croix and in the Virgin Islands, which is an area that does, I mean, if you think that Puerto Rico's treatment by the United States is bad, you should see what's going on in the Virgin Islands. They're even further removed away from, you know, control of their own administration and area. But there's a lot of folks who are doing just kind of cultural rehabilitation and reclaiming their own Afro-Caribbean roots. And sometimes that involves, you know, rehabilitating buildings. Sometimes it even involves taking out long-term leases and rehabilitating historical buildings that they don't even own. Sometimes it involves, you know, inviting scholars to give talks and to come and survey sites. And then other times it involves, you know, having food festivals. So, you know, most of the people there are African American, and they're just reclaiming their own heritage because they realize that they're taught the same Common Core standards that the U.S. mainland forces on students, and that wasn't cutting it. And so they've got their own alternative form of knowledge that is, you know, just that's what they teach their people. So when you talk to them about historic preservation or whatever, they're kind of just thinking like, oh, well, you know, yeah, of course we would fix that building because we could. And then sometimes we're just going to lose buildings. And of course they would have a tour that goes to the big house and only shows that. But, you know, we have our own tour for our own people and our own children, and we tell them the truth about, you know, local knowledge and who we are. And so that doesn't, there's not really a way to quantify it, because us coming from, you know, the state's parties or the state or the organized realm, our data can't really capture that kind of stuff, but it's actually happening.
That's a really good point, Bill. And, you know, I'm kind of in a similar position to you, where I've been moving into Caribbean archaeology in the last couple of years as well. And I'm over a bit more strongly within the you know, on Hispaniola and Haiti and Dominican Republic. And what you just described is replicated pretty strongly there as well. So, I mean, to be honest with you, the interactions we've had with a lot of the communities and some of the indigenous communities leaders that I've talked to, like with the Kalinago down in the southern part of the archipelago in the Lesser Antilles, it made me feel like there's a better hope for there being more bottom up oriented discussions happening when some of these heritage groups come to town, so to speak. And then when I coded everything, I was a bit disappointed. In fact, I think it's only one site in the Caribbean actually ended up being more horizontally organized. I was expecting there to be a lot more focus on, some of the indigenous communities prior to contact. And there's almost nothing of those unless they accidentally fall within more colonial structures. and then Maroon communities and Garifuna communities and things like that. And that's just not, sadly, that's not preserved, but it's clear that with the groups that we've talked to, that that's what they are interested in. That's what they want to see preserved. So
it also reminds me of some of the things that I've heard, you know, working with native groups that, you know, you get the permission to know things based on, I guess, how down for the cause you are or whether they have the rights to share certain things, right? But the idea that, you know, Indians are gone or that native culture was destroyed or something like that, that's not in any way close to true, because if you are an ally and you are someone who they actually share some of this knowledge with, you'll see that they've maintained thousands of years worth of knowledge, even though it almost got destroyed through genocide and, you know, epidemic diseases. So that knowledge doesn't actually go into site preservation a lot of times because we're the ones who are the agents of the destruction. So they're not going to share a lot of that stuff with us. And I think in the Caribbean, you know, and in Black communities, there's definitely local knowledge too that a lot of times doesn't get shared because of who we are. When we come in and we try to do preservation programs or something like that, a lot of times they don't share their techniques with how they've survived because, you know, some of that stuff, especially in the Black community, is not exactly in the, you know, law book or whatever as ethical ways that you would survive or basically legal things, strategies you'd use to survive. So, you know, they're not going to tell us any of that stuff because that doesn't fit the, you know, dominant paradigm. So I don't know if there is a way for our data collection system to ever really get to that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't really get into much problem solving in that article. Sadly, I wish I could have actually extended more into that aspect of it because I'm uncomfortable highlighting problems without at least potential solutions. But the little bit of potential solutions I did bring up is to actually try to, you know, focus on decoupling some of these decisions from government and state, you know, city, county practices. And that's why I think the next step is to start looking at not just tribal governments, because sometimes, you know, as like folks like Glenn Coulthard up in Canada have argued, the, you know, the structures that of political power for interacting with the state are kind of replicating a lot of these colonial processes within some of the tribal groups as well. But NGOs within the tribe or and you know, non-tribal NGOs as well, see if they can start making more informed comprehensive preservation management decisions. Not that tribal groups aren't making informed management decisions, but a lot of these NGOs, again, are just doing it. Instead of taking all the data points together, they're just kind of going with what they run across.
Well, cool. I think this is a good breaking point. So we're going to jump to the break and then come back for the third segment and talk about potential solutions for how we work with this. Back in a bit.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
Welcome back. We're talking with Lewis Bork about anarchy and various aspects in CRM, and Sonia had the next question. Sonia.
Yeah, so Lewis, as I was reading through your article, all I could think of was, all right, great. How am I going to apply chronopolitics in the modern world? And specifically, like, with regard to how we practice archaeology with more recent artifacts. And when I say recent, I mean things that are just coming into period. And a lot of states in the East say, if it's 1950, or if it was deposited or made after 1950, we don't care. So they don't have this strict 50-year rule that we seem to have more in the West. And there are states that are starting to go, okay, you know what? There are so many pop top cans along transportation routes that were created in the or constructed during the like the 1960s and early 1970s. We've got so much of this stuff. How are we going to manage it? Are we going to have to point plot every single pop top can or whatever we have out there, and every single drainage ditch along the highway or every single light pole on the street? Or can we assume that those items are, yes, part of the historic context, but not necessary to record? How does that affect how we practice archaeology in the field and make recommendations to our clients? And, I mean, if we think about it as contractors, our job is to do work for our clients to assist them in fulfilling their obligations under federal and state law, right? But this 50-year rule isn't always a thing all over or consistently across the United States. So how are we going to deal with all of this extra new stuff? And how does how does this affect this difference between the means creating the end and the ends justifying the means?
I mean, in my view of this, at least in terms of what you're asking, is I think it's related to this concern with us kind of coming up to the or having already passed the mass manufacturing period, and now we're hitting like the onset of plastic and the being recorded through the 50-year rule and everything as well. And you know, the cheap answer for me, I think, is that we can start making decisions as heritage professionals that are more class conscious in some ways and conscious of other groups that have been, you know, marginalized from the historical record, and many of which are actually popping up, so to speak, along these, you know, travel corridors, because so many of them are so many of these groups use mobility as a kind of survival mechanism. I mean, that's not to say that all of mobile groups that you're going to find during these periods are many of them are upper middle class and doing quite well as also. But so I think one thing that you can do is you know, obviously you have structures, legal structures that you're working within, and ethically you can't breach those legal structures. That's completely correct. But because because one of the things that you're always having to be conscious of is these restrictions, you're also having to be conscious, I think, and what I'm trying to argue, of the narrative that you're producing through arguing for preservation of these sites. And so there's one of my favorite activists and theorists is this woman, Lucy Parsons. And she was one of the founders of the Industrial Workers of the World. She's a Black Indigenous woman. From what we can tell, she escaped slavery in Mexico and got into the United States. She ended up marrying a man who was a soldier in the Confederate Army. And the two of them became some of the founders for the Industrial Workers of the World. So I'd love to know more about that story, about how those two got together and became radical left activists together. One of the things that her and this group have always advocated for is not even necessarily these, you know, explosive, massive revolutions, but to always, and this is what prefiguration is essentially, is to always do what you would like to see in the future in the present. So just practice what you're trying to attain. So if the concern is that there are certain archaeological objects that are often ignored by people, but may be indicative of groups or, you know, however you might define them, ethnic or class-based groups that are often being erased, then I think we have space within these legal restrictions to actually start making decisions about what we can and can consider to be preservational or, you know, worthy of preservation.
I think one thing that we are trying to consider as professionals is this bias that we have toward the kind of the cool We see a lot of like the elite status people represented overwhelmingly in the archaeological record, but we see the common man, I'm just going to put that in quotes there, the common man is grossly underrepresentative in the archaeological, when I say archaeological record, I mean what's documented by archaeologists. The problem is that the elite status folks that we are overrepresenting in our cultural histories, in our discussions about life and culture, is actually a very, very tiny part of culture in general. And then what we are missing are these things that the common man, the common person, but their debris, if you'll forgive the term, their debris is huge. So balancing that debris that we are recording from the common person or the common man versus what we are seeing, the more ornate, the more interesting, what we find more interesting, I think chronopolitically or even politically, we're having a hard time balancing that. Why investigate a tiny little lithic scatter versus going and checking out, you know, Chaco Canyon? Does that make sense? And how are we going to balance that type of research? If I just take my example of pop top cans, which are now in period, and we record all of the pop top cans along highway, you know, I-70, I-15, I-25, if we're talking about Colorado and Utah area, which I'm quite familiar with, we'll get thousands upon thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands, you know, possibly even more than that of these artifacts. But when we find these small little, smaller little sites that have maybe residential areas, we become much more interested in that because we feel that it's more representative or it's more interesting. So are we biased by politics? Are we biased by interest? Are politics and interest kind of commingle? And how do we balance that hugely overrepresented class, meaning the common man, in the dirt versus what we see very small amounts of, the elite status, in the dirt?
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with as well.
We're talking thousands upon thousands of things versus very few things. So yeah, we're balancing. But if we're made to record things that are within the 50-year rule, we're going to be dealing with a lot more than can we reasonably manage.
Yeah, I mean, no, I 100% agree with you. I mean, what you're saying is, I think what you're saying, one of the outcomes that could be from focusing too much on these non-elite status items is that we're just going to get swamped with data and conservation.
And it also adds a considerable amount of cost to our clients.
Yeah.
So are we essentially, by balancing things out, recording them in the field, in the dirt, are we actually increasing costs to our clients who then go back to government and say, archaeology's become outrageously expensive? And then the government says, well, archaeology is ridiculous, and then gets rid of or downgrades certain laws, in which case then we go back to your article where we're talking about politics.
I maintain that, and I have for a very long time maintained that the clients who don't actually have an interest in historic preservation or cultural resources will always complain that it's too expensive and takes too long, regardless of how expensive or how much time it takes. And so it doesn't matter. Like, you know, we could second guess ourselves and try to be like, well, like we don't want to be too expensive. We don't want to take too much time because, you know, they'll just complain. They're already complaining. They'll still complain. It doesn't matter. Like, we should be focused on what it takes to do the job. You know, I mean, I understand, like, there is a reasonable amount of time to do stuff. And for the ubiquity of the pop top can horizon, yeah, you know, it's like maybe
we still need to consider these as sites or record them as sites, if for no other reason than to get them off the books. But we, you know, maybe we need to consider kind of a shorthand sort of acknowledging their existence and then moving on. And you know, it's like, yep, can scatter, quickly record it, you know, rough number of cans, done. And then have it, you know, being essentially a CADEX sort of thing where it's like it doesn't have to be more formally evaluated against the National Register criteria.
Yeah, I think realistically, I mean, it sounds like there's really like two problems here. One's sort of a theoretical, one's a methodological problem. The methodological problem is, you know, do we treat these, do we have to treat all artifacts equally? Or do we develop different methods for different types of artifacts? Like, do you need to count every pull tab, or can you just take a picture of pull tabs and go, that's somewhere between 100 and 1,000, and move on with your day and your life, as opposed to if you're finding sort of, you know, intact ceramic pieces, which then could, you know, or sort of lithics of some kind, which can be, you know, studied a little more in a little more detail and so forth. So that's sort of the methodological problem with this one. I think the theoretical problem, though, I think is one of what are we doing this for? And who are we doing this for? I mean, a CRM archaeologist, in the end, we are sort of pseudo agents of government agencies. We are out there because a government, whether a federal or state or other local government, has put a law into the books that says cultural resources are important and they must be evaluated before X, Y, Z, whether it's a permit, development, or whatever else is occurring there. So we occupy that space as that, and we should never forget that in that way we are an agent of sort of the hierarchical power that exists today in this world. But we also sort of occupy a liminal state where we also are representing the artifacts and the people, more importantly, the people who created and used and disposed of those artifacts in the past. So we sort of take this weird liminal space where we have to negotiate and as best we can, the story of those people in the past, whether today we would call them significant or not, they're still people who lived, breathed, died, and disposed of these artifacts here, with the goals of the government of telling good nationalistic stories to create good workers and soldiers for the future. So, you know, we have to remember where we stand in that. So,
one of the things that this article had me thinking about, and I'll confess that I've been thinking about it a lot in general, you know, even prior to reading this, is the notion that archaeology is, you know, like the point of archaeology is to give a voice to the voiceless of the past, right? Like we're not necessarily trying to look at like the big important historical figures, particularly in more recent historically documented times where, you know, like the rich and powerful already have their stories out there, and we're trying to look at, like I say, provide the voice for the voiceless. It strikes me that in turn is, for us, like that puts us like in a massive position of empowerment for ourselves, where it's like we get to dictate, you know, who's the voiceless and what exactly is their voice, right? We're kind of maintaining our own hierarchical structure in how we, you know, what the stories we tell.
And that is definitely a trap.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's a big trap. This is where I think we have to first, you know, we need to get to the point where we're being aware of how we're making these significance judgments, because we're clearly, you know, there are, you know, contemporary biases that we apply to the archaeological record. And then the next step is then, you know, thinking about how we can counteract those. And so this is kind of like what Bill was talking about in the Caribbean and how Southwestern archaeology in a lot of ways has been moving forward. And I keep bringing Southwestern up because that's my primary background. But, you know, and this is stepping outside of archaeologists as always leading this conversation, or at least all of us getting comfortable with there being voices at the table that have as much power as us, if not more power than us, to start making this discussion or making these determinations.
Well, cool. Anybody have any final thoughts?
No, I think that this has been a great discussion, and I think it's something that we should consider thinking a little bit more about in the future, especially as we move into application of how we consider our own biases, how politics plays in archaeology, and what we do in the dirt. So thank you very much for coming on, Lewis.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This was fun.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field.
See you later.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.